independent artists and their teams are really expected to do a lot of the heavy lifting mm-hmm. based on the system we have set up today, as far as making sure that they are getting paid for their work and figuring out their own problems with these platforms, because the platforms do have to maintain neutrality whenever there's a dispute that comes up. And mm-hmm. It puts the onus on an independent artist. And as we both know, like, there's more and more indie artists every single year. Like, that's yep. the bulk of the industry. Yep. People are taking this as like a learning lesson mm. of how to protect yourself a little bit better. You know, I'm sure some people are hoping for systemic change in different ways to the digital royalties system. But yes. I think the immediate, that there are a lot more managers, artists, songwriters, et cetera, that are checking.
Once again, I want to remind you that Ari's Take Academy is open for enrollment right now, but it's closing in a few days. We only open enrollment twice a year. If you want to check out the courses that we have, from touring to registration and release schedule and digital marketing and streaming growth and all the other great stuff that we cover from the experts in the field. But don't take it from me. Take it from one of our students, Colby Knickerbocker.
Hey guys, it's Colby Knickerbocker. I'm a singer-songwriter, currently residing in Bend, Oregon, and I'm enrolled in the Advanced Sync Strategies for Film and Television. When I enrolled in the course, I was surprised, genuinely surprised, at how much I didn't know before the course. There's so much value in the course per chapter, or per word, per sentence that you read. It's really astonishing. It's succinct and concise as to what value you get. The course is already paid for itself four times over. And I will say the other aspect that is extremely valuable is the actual group of people. I recommend this course to anyone who's in music.
Head over to ariestakeacademy.com. Use the code NMB for 10% off. What's going on? Welcome to the New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book, third edition, coming very soon. Today, my guest is Kristen Robinson. She is an investigative journalist for Billboard, and I invited her on the show to talk about her incredible piece, very in-depth investigative report entitled How Did Two Unknown Latin Music Operators Make $23 Million from YouTube? The IRS says they stole it. She spent a long time working on this piece and details how, unfortunately, how easy it is for malicious parties to steal other artists and songwriters' money from YouTube royalties. Now, we actually break down how broken this system is, and even if the parties aren't acting maliciously, how money gets, reallocated or allocated incorrectly, mistakenly or otherwise, to parties that don't deserve this money from YouTube. But also, this is a case that she uncovered where these parties were acting maliciously and ran this very successful scam for a while until they got caught. So Kristen breaks down this story, but I encourage everybody to read this incredible article. It's on Billboard now, and you can learn more about that over on Billboard. Just search for that article. We're going to link it in the show notes as well. We also dive deep into copyright and registration and royalties and the importance of indie artists understanding how all this works, and the importance of indie artists and songwriters properly registering their works across all platforms. So this is why I work so hard, and everybody on the Ari's Take team works so hard to help educate the community and make sure that we know how all of the royalties work and how you should register your stuff. So make sure, which brings me to, make sure you are on the Ari's Take email list, because we send out helpful articles and resources all the time. Just head over to ariestake.com, get on that email list. That's where you're going to find the most up-to-date information and where we'll send all the resources about all of this kind of stuff. You can find Kristen Robinson on Instagram and Twitter at Words by Kristen. You can find all of us that make the show happen at Ari's Take on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. You can find me at Ari Herstan on Instagram and Twitter. Please pause this right now and click the subscribe or follow button, however you're listening to us right now. Follow us so you'll get us in your feed as we release more episodes. And leave us a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Those really help. And I do need to say that I had some audio issues during this episode, so the audio quality isn't quite up to the Ari's Take New Music Business standards, but it is audible, and you're going to have just a fine time listening to this episode, but it will sound a little bit different than the other episodes, and that's why. All right, let's kick into the show. Kristen Robinson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. So excited to be here.
Yeah, so we're here to talk about your incredible investigative report that you did for Billboard. This is one of the most, this was one of the most engaging pieces that I've read in a very long time. My jaw just kept dropping further and further to the ground. The way it's just like it went deeper and deeper. And there was like a jewelry thing happening, and there was a houses being bought with all this crazy money. There was like there's a lime green Lamborghini being driven around with these butterfly doors. I'm just like, oh my gosh, it was crazy. I felt like I was watching a TV show or reading an incredible mystery novel. I want to break this down a little bit. I want you to talk about the story. First off, I'm going to read the headline because, there's a great headline. How did two unknown Latin music operators make $23 million from YouTube? The IRS says they stole it. Well, as someone who has written headlines professionally for the last 10 years, that is a great headline. That would get anyone to read it.
Yeah.
And, it got me to read it. And then it didn't get me to stop reading it until I finished it an hour later, because it is a deep, very in-depth piece. So first off, can you just summarize, just break down, give us the bullet points of what happened here? What's going on with this?
Yeah. So the story is based on a lot of court documents that I've read and interviews I've had with sources in the industry that were aligned or adjacent to this scam. And basically what the IRS is alleging is that this company called MediaMove, which was founded by two guys, both of them living out of Phoenix, that they had devised a YouTube royalty scam and ended up stealing $23 million worth of royalties from songwriters and artists who had their music on YouTube but weren't properly claiming it. Mm-hmm. And so it left them kind of susceptible to a fraud like this. And this goes all the way up to gigantic acts like Daddy Yankee, Anuel A.A., I think that's how you pronounce it. Sorry, people who speak Spanish, if that was wrong. But like tons of very important Latin music artists. And yeah, I mean, it was a very interesting story to research. My jaw was dropping as I was researching it. But, you know, there's it raises a lot of interesting questions, I think, about how digital royalties work in general, and especially how they work on YouTube, and especially for those independent artists out there, which I know a lot of them listen to a lot of your work. Mm-hmm. Are you safe online? Like, have you actually done all the checks that are necessary to make sure that your music is being properly monetized? So,
Well, and thank you. That's a great summary. And we are going to get into, I'm excited to get into your process in writing this story, but I want to hit that later. First off, let's dig a little bit deeper into the nuts and bolts of what happened here. We have an informed listenership here. I think we can get into the weeds of what went down a little bit more, because I correct me if I'm wrong, it does have a little bit to do with properly registering, but also it even has more to do with these scammers, mm-hmm. this MediaMove company, via their YouTube, I guess, content ID administrator, I guess, collections agency, whatever you want to call it, AdRev. They falsely claimed
that they represented or co-owned some of these recordings and songs, rather, because, like, I think you mentioned in your piece a little bit how, especially in songs with multiple co-writers, that entails multiple publishers, it's oftentimes hard to know if everything is being properly registered or claimed. And even if it's a publisher, it's like, oh yeah, there were five songwriters on this. There's, you know, four other publishers or something like that. So it might even get missed that, I mean, these people were flat out illegally scamming this. So break all this down a little bit, and we'll go into how, like, this can be done maliciously, like how MediaMove did it, but also how it can be done not necessarily maliciously, but also just
kind of accidental.
Accidentally, right, because the system is broken. We'll talk about that later, but talk about this first bit a little bit more.
Yeah, so how this alleged scam was facilitated. So MediaMove, which was really an unknown entity, I don't think that they really had an online presence. They had kind of a random website that they threw up at one point and like a little bit of a Facebook page, but it didn't, you know, they didn't really have firm operations, but somehow they ended up getting access to YouTube's content management system, or CMS. You also might hear it being called Content Manager. Within this, another tool that's very popular that people talk about a lot is Content ID, which is specific to sound recordings. But basically, if you have access to Content Manager, then you have the ability to make sure that you are claiming your songs properly. You can see the splits behind the scenes. If you're representing songwriters, you can check and make sure that your songwriters have their correct splits inputted. Sound recordings, same thing. But not everyone has access to this. I was certainly a little surprised that these guys, because they didn't have a high profile in the industry already, were able to get access to CMS, but I'm actually not sure what went into that part, but they had access to CMS and started to claim, they ultimately claimed over 50,000 different sound recordings and compositions on YouTube, saying that they were the rights holders. So, like, whether that meant that they were the label or they bought these catalogs or they were the managers, they were kind of acting like they were on these artists and songwriters' teams. And to help them collect this money, because it is a very tedious process to collect on that many copyrights, they entered a contract with AdRev, which is a rights management company. It's owned by Downtown Music Holdings. During the majority of the scheme, that process had, like, Downtown didn't own that company, but they bought the company, I believe, in 2019.
CD Baby acquisition. CD Baby used to own AdRev, and they were when Downtown bought CD Baby and all of the other entities that they were part of, it. That's when they acquired it.
It's kind of like a Russian doll situation. It's like there's AdRev, and then there's CD Baby, and then there's Downtown.
But yeah, SongTrust is in there somewhere.
SongTrust is in there. And so they signed a contract with AdRev, which is one of the largest rights managers that has expertise with YouTube collection. And they started collecting these royalties for MediaMove.
I just want to pause right there just to explain the AdRev model a little bit for people that aren't really familiar, because it is a web and it is very extremely confusing. And as someone who studies this for a living, I'm still unraveling it and trying to understand how all this works. So break down a little bit what AdRev does kind of specifically and how they operate as these administrators.
Yeah, so these administrators are very important to the YouTube ecosystem. There's a ton of them. If you look up, like, YouTube has a lot of different pages for creators to educate themselves that they're oftentimes using YouTube. And one of the pages that they offer is like a services directory listing a bunch of these types of companies. And basically what these companies do is they have CMS access, and they have a team of people that understand how the YouTube system works. So if you're a business that's smaller, or if you're, you know, a singular songwriter or a singular artist, and you're looking to make sure that on YouTube, everything is in line and that you're going to be collecting properly, a lot of people will recommend that you sign on to one of these rights managers like AdRev, and they will collect the money for you and make sure that no one's claiming your songs for you. And in turn, they take a fee of anywhere between 10% of the royalties they bring in for you up to, I think, about 25%. It really is a wide range. It depends on who you are, what kind of leverage you have as to what kind of deal you would get with the rights manager. But they're important to YouTube because YouTube wants to keep CMS and their content ID tools gated. They don't want everyone to see everything because I think the logic with that, I believe, is that if everyone had access, then people would abuse the system. So they want to keep it to trusted partners. But what's unfortunate here is that it ended up being that MediaMove was not a very trustworthy entity. So anyways, that's kind of like the gist of why you would sign with a rights manager.
So to illustrate this a little bit, I'll use myself as an example. So if I'm, you know, I'm a songwriter, artist, if there are people out there that are covering my song, they're uploading cover videos to YouTube of my song. Let's say there's thousands of artists out there, you know, creators uploading covers to my composition. I could enlist a company like AdRev to go collect to AdRev could tell YouTube, slap some ads on these videos because they contain my composition. And then AdRev is kind of acting as my administrator so I could get paid some revenue from the ad revenue because these videos use my composition because they're covering my song. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, I don't know what the threshold is. There is a threshold for how many views a video has to get before you can monetize it. But if you have like quite a few different very popular covers, I believe that would be the process for that. With covers specifically, as a songwriter, and you have maybe a really popular song out there that everyone's playing themselves.
Yeah.
Covers are really difficult to track because the content ID system for YouTube is really good at identifying sound recordings that match.
Okay.
But it's way harder for it to match up, you know, amateur cover artists with your composition. So I think that like having an extra team behind you that can check up on everything and make sure that they're actually catching those covers that are slipping through the cracks probably because they are sufficiently different and claiming those for you can be very important for a songwriter's revenue.
So in addition to, Content ID specializes in kind of on the other side, the other copyright that we're talking about. So I just referenced and illustrated the composition copyright. Now, when we're talking about the sound recording copyright, that's a lot easier because YouTube's Content ID system, it's essentially like, you know, a Shazam or like kind of just like a, you know, sonic recognition software that they have where they crawl every video. Actually, I think, you know, before it actually gets published there, it goes through their Content ID system. And if it's a recording, like, you know, if I were to upload a video using a Beyonce track, that would get caught immediately. And Beyonce's label, via whoever is running their Content ID, their label could basically has the option to either monetize it, slap an ad on it, saying we want to earn from this, or take it down. And they could say, you know what, we don't want any videos with this sound recording, and we're just going to ask you to take it out. And I believe the content, I believe the YouTube gives you that option through Content ID. Is like what do you want to do when we spot one of these recordings? Is that right? Mm-hmm.
I'm honestly not super familiar with the process of uploading a video that has a sound recording in it, but I believe that's correct. I feel like you oftentimes see people trying to upload videos and having them flagged or held back because they contain copyrighted material. So I believe that's correct.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, you know, that happens all the time. And so I want to get to that in a little bit too, on where it's happening accidentally, because I have personal experience with this, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But I want to continue on this story. So Media Move, these two guys, they somehow have. Now, this is where I guess I was a little confused. You're saying that they got access to Content Manager, YouTube's Content Manager, before they were working with AdRev, or they got access to it because AdRev gave them the access?
No, they ended up getting access independently of AdRev, but wow. I believe the reason there's nothing that says exactly why they decided that they would still pair with AdRev having that access themselves, but I believe that this system is quite tricky. And I think that would make a lot of sense still to want to partner with the rights manager to ensure that you don't have to do all the legwork. And AdRev is has been a trusted partner of YouTube's for a very long time. So I bet they have a stronger rapport with the YouTube reps there. And
that makes sense. Well, now this is so interesting. So you said MediaMove claimed that they represented around 50,000 copyrights, sound recording and composition copyrights in some capacity. And so what was starting to happen was that, well, I guess let me ask you, how did this come to light? How did anyone discover what they were doing, and how did they get caught? Because they got caught. You were able to write the story.
Yeah, they did get caught. It really started very grassroots. I think it was just a lot in the very beginning, which was around 2017 when they started claiming songs and recordings. It was a lot of people that just started noticing on the bottom of their videos that there's something called Media Move that was claiming their royalties. And so people started making, ironically, YouTube videos being like, I think these guys are fraudsters. I think they're stealing from me. Or who is Media Move? Why are they claiming my song? This is not theirs. There was a Twitter account that was set up, and it's still running. If anyone wants to follow it, it was a great source of information for me too. It's called Fuck Media Move. Straight cool. into the point there.
Yep. right.
So there was that. There was also a Facebook page where people kind of just gathered to commiserate about their videos being claimed and their songs being claimed by Media Move. And unfortunately, I don't think that it really led to much, except for the fact that these people were just upset and trying to find ways to get their music back. Additionally, there was another rights manager who spoke with me extensively and shared a lot of emails with me, who had a lot of his the artists and other rights holders that actually work with him that were being claimed by Media Move. And so he did a lot of work trying to connect with AdRev and be like, I need to get these songs back. These are actually my artist songs.
Right.
That took place a lot in 2018. That's when that guy's works are being claimed a lot. And they went back and forth quite a bit. And I think he said that it was, quote, hundreds of incorrect claims for his rights holders. So pretty crazy.
I mean, yeah, and this is, I'm assuming, the pseudonym Gabriel that you reference in the piece so much. Now did all of, I'm, well, this gets into the kind of the how you wrote this, and while you're writing this, how did you decide, and where and why did you decide that some people would get pseudonyms and some people, because you named names. I mean, you named, Noah Becker from, co-founder of AdRev, who then had to resign and it's no longer. And then you wrote a follow-up piece saying he's now out from the company. And you did name some names, even the father of the serial killer who's on trial for, or something like that. I think I got that right. I'm just man, you got some guts, like naming some of these things. I was like, oh, I don't know if I would like go that far. But so, yeah, who did you decide? Where did you draw the line of who's going to get a name and who you would use as an anonymous source?
So a lot of my information for this story was from court documents where these names were listed. So these court documents are publicly available. There were a lot to sort through, and it takes a lot of time and effort to go through all of them. So most people have not done that. But within those, most of the names that were listed in the story were already publicly available and tied to this case. Gotcha. As far as like some of my sources that they would request a pseudonym from me. Okay. And so they would tell me, I'll speak to you. I have valuable information, but I need to remain anonymous for my safety or for the safety of my business. And I really do think that people don't talk enough about how brave it is to be a source for a controversial story. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like Gabriel, for example, this is his livelihood, and he really put himself on the line and had to trust me that I was going to, you know, uphold my end of the bargain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was willing to share a lot of personal company emails with me, which really helped lock down a lot of different facts for me, which is so helpful. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so basically, if a source is asking and requesting anonymity, it's likely that they will get that. I've never had an instance where an editor has told me that we're not allowed to give someone anonymity. But I think that for a journalist, it is very sacred. If someone says this conversation is off the record, or this conversation, I need to remain anonymous, but you can quote me, that we honor that, because if you don't do that, I mean, just as a human being, that's cruel and a betrayal of trust. But that, I think that's pretty unethical as a journalist as well. So that's why certain people had pseudonyms and other people were named.
Yeah, that's great. No, I mean, it was, very, very well researched, well investigated, and, you know, very ethically done. How long did it take you to do this story?
It took a long time.
Seems that way.
So honestly, the full journey of the story before the story was even a story started like September of 2021. I did a call just to get to know, I do a lot of get to know you calls with various people just to like learn more about what they do and make new friends. And I did a call with someone who works in a different rights management company. And he was like, you know, you should do a story on about the rights management space and about how often people get scammed on YouTube. And I had never heard of that before in my life. And I understand that like sometimes money is routed to the wrong person from a streaming service or something, but I didn't really understand how YouTube was a unique platform and it required unique skills, and that there's this whole cottage industry of YouTube rights management. And he kind of introduced that to me, and he even walked me through some songs on the Billboard Hot 100 that he suspected had been misclaimed, and whether that was by accident or a true scam, it's hard to tell, but it blew my mind. And I remember writing an email to like everyone that I was working with, and I had just gotten to Billboard at this point. So it's like 2 months.
Was this Jeff Price?
No, it was not. Okay. It was not. But
he did this to me like 8 years ago, and he showed me that. And I was like, I know you quoted him in your story also. I was like, okay, he knows it. But anyway, continue. Gotcha.
Yeah, no, it wasn't Jeff, but Jeff is a very smart guy and is always looking to challenge and push the industry.
Yeah.
So the source didn't end up being a part of the story later, but the stuff that they told me just really sparked my curiosity in it. And so I just started learning more about this space. And all my editors knew that I was like really, really fascinated by it. And then eventually someone else at Billboard got sent the indictment against the two co-founders of MediaMove. And they were like, you guys should cover this. Like, I'm willing to be a source if you want to look into it. And it was actually Gabriel, who ended up mentioned in the story. And that editor remembered that I had been going on and on about how fascinating the world of YouTube royalties is and sent it over to me. And it was a slow start. And, you know, I have plenty of things that I'm working on all at once, but I just kind of kept chipping away at it. And then one of the two co-founders of Media Move, for those who haven't read the story, they ended up pleading guilty in late April of 2022. Right. And so that's kind of when the floodgates opened to me. I had been doing a lot of research, especially like at night or on weekends, because I had a full plate of other stories.
Sure.
And when the plea deal came out that had Webster Batista, one of the two co-founders of Media Move, saying explicitly, I stole $23 million of YouTube royalties. And like hearing from his own words that it wasn't just an indictment, it's not just the IRS accusing them. There's one of the two guys who's willing to admit that that happened. It really led to me diving completely in. I don't know if you've seen that meme of like, It's Always Sunny, and it's the big board with all the yarn and all the photos. It's like this conspiracy theory guy, and he like looks like he's going insane. That's kind of like where I got to. And I was like, I'm all alone in this. I was diving so deep into it. And I was finding all of these, you know, adjacent people, like Webster's wife and Webster's new girlfriend. There's seemingly a financial possible link between certain people that were around these guys that were never included in the indictment, but were included in other court documents that no one had found before, but they're out there. It's just, you have to know. Anyways, I felt like I was going crazy. but luckily, I and there were definitely points where I didn't know if it would all come together, but I'm grateful that I was able to weave together a lot of the story. But, you know, to do something like this, I take the responsibility of saying anything that is not super glowing about someone in the press very seriously. And it takes a lot of corroboration. You can't just take someone's word for it. Mm-hmm. You have to do a lot of digging, get a lot of, you know, emails, court documents, all these like very definite sourcing to make sure that the story is solid. And I'm grateful that I was able to put it together.
I'm curious, you know, as dabbled in, I guess, you know, journalism a bit and have written for various publications and all of this, and have, of course, the blog, Ari's Take. What was the process? Did you have an editor that you were working alongside, or were you kind of left to your own devices and then presented kind of the first draft with your sources and then went from there? Mm-hmm. Or do you have the keys to their back end and they're just like, go for it, we trust you, and you just published, and the first time they read it was it was public?
I definitely had a lot of editing, and I really think it takes the village. I have such a deep respect. I'm still like towards the beginning of my career. I've been at Billboard for a little over a year now, and before that I worked for a record label, so I'm fairly new in the game at journalism. And I didn't really realize until I went through this process and the process of one other story that I worked on that was quite intensive about 6 months ago, that it requires a village to present a story that's investigative. And so now when I read other stories that are really deep dives, I just think about all the hours that the writer, their editor, their sources all put in to making it happen. And that's not to get on a soapbox about journalism, but that's why it's so important. Like the Harvey Weinstein article, I think about that one all the time.
Oh yeah.
That must have taken so many hours.
And oh my gosh,
I'm very grateful that that writer was willing to spend the time to do that. But yeah, so for this story, I had a couple editors that were really, you know, championing the story. They knew that I was passionate about it and willing to give me time to work on it, and were willing to take my bizarre phone calls where I was telling them about all the weird things that I had found, the Lamborghini photo and, you know, the diamond chains and all this stuff. And I feel very grateful to be supported at Billboard. But there, I would say there were quite a few editors that took a look. And we also went through it with a lawyer to make sure that everything was sound. And but yeah, it was a long process.
That's awesome. That's really illuminating and really cool to hear the process of how it went about it. And it's nice to hear that there were many checks along the way. You know, mm-hmm. I've been in situations in the past where I have done investigative stories that got published, but there was no real editorial oversight, and it was really all me, and it was all on me. And I, you know, and that's the other thing, is just like, at least when you have a team, they back you up and you're kind of in it together. And like, when mm-hmm. you hit, when somebody hits publish, it's like, okay, it's now on everyone, not just your own ass. It's like everyone's ass is on the line, and it's billboards. Whereas like in the past, I've done similar stories where it was just like, well, it's all me. And I've gotten, you know, lawsuit threats. I've gotten death threats. I've gotten, you know, all of that, which comes along with this, which is like, I know, you know, a little bit of kind of what potentially you could go through. Have you gotten any blowback from the people named in this article at all?
Once again, I want to let you know that Ari's Take Academy enrollment is open right now, but we only open it twice a year for a very limited amount of time. It's only open for actually a few more days. Check out the courses that we have right now and join the other 6,000 students that are leveling up their music careers. We have courses from booking and touring and streaming growth to sync licensing and our newest one, registration, royalties, and release. All great stuff. Head on over to ariestakeacademy.com. Use the code NMB, stands for New Music Business, for 10% off.
I mean, I wouldn't say people who are named are especially happy about it, but I truly, nothing that was disrespectful has happened. I honestly was prepared, even maybe, this happens to journalists, which you alluded to, like just doxing or like death threats. I've actually not gotten any of that. And I'm grateful that has not happened. But you know, I've also gotten a lot of really positive feedback, from lots of people in the industry. You know, lots of people sending me DMs and stuff saying that, you know, for the first time they checked to make sure that their artist was taken care of on YouTube and realized that a couple of their songs weren't, and it wasn't malicious, but they just didn't realize that they needed to check on that. And I'm grateful that that's been a lot of the feedback that I've gotten, that people are taking this as like a learning lesson of how to protect yourself a little bit better. You know, I'm sure some people are hoping for systemic change in different ways to the digital royalties system, but I think the immediate, that there are a lot more managers, artists, songwriters, etc., that are checking is huge. So
it's so necessary, and this is what I was alluding to before, which I'll talk about now a little bit. You know, I discovered part of this problem firsthand about a year ago, when I uploaded a live from the studio video to YouTube on our own channel of my funk project, Brassroots District. And we had recorded a live from the studio song of a song that I wrote by myself, 100%. And we recorded it live in the studio. There's no samples. There's no other recordings out there. This was literally created on the spot, uploaded. Instantly, it got, I'll share my screen. And those of you who are watching on YouTube, you'll see it. Instantly, it got claimed by Latin author Perf, Songtrust, UMPG Publishing, that's Universal Music Publishing Group, Cobalt, and Concord Music Publishing.
What? Now,
instantly. So, hi, Brassroots District, the following claim, this was instant. And I'm like, okay, one, it's all bullshit, because I wrote the song by myself. I've registered the copyright. I've registered it with, you know, I am with Songtrust. So this was accurate. Songtrust was the only one that should have been claimed it, but not Latin author Perf, definitely not Universal, definitely not Cobalt or Concord. And it's our own recording. So it's like, there's no one that could even possibly claim it. We had used any of their samples or anything like this. So this is my article. If people want to look it up, it's YouTube Content ID is a scam. I wrote this in June of 2021. And I kind of go into a lot of these mechanisms, because here's the thing. It's well, for one, just to continue this, I know better, and I know that I own all these rights and no one should be claiming this and making money off of my intellectual property or my video. So I disputed the claim, and that's what every artist should do. If you get a claim, a false claim on your video, you dispute it, and they have 30 days, the people that made the claim, to release it, or they can actually submit a takedown notice or reinstate it, which that goes in even deeper to the issues surrounding a lot of this rights management, because fortunately nobody fought me on it. They would have lost. They released their claims, and now I have all of the revenue that ads are generating coming to me. But most artists don't know to do that. Most artists, frankly, are terrified that they're going to do something wrong and get a copyright strike, because we know the law says, the law from 1998 that for some dumb reason has not been updated yet, that there's a three strike rule. And if you get three strikes, they are required to rip your account down. So if you get three strikes on your YouTube account, YouTube will just remove your profile. This is now happening across the board. Now, I don't know if you read Elias Light's story on he called it "Artists Are Leveraging False Infringement Claims Against Rivals." This is he wrote this in July, or published it in July on Billboard. And basically what's happening there, which is really fucked up, is that artists people in general are essentially issuing takedown notices, copyright claims against other artists, rightly or wrongly, saying that, this is I own this copyright. And platforms like Spotify and YouTube and others and Instagram essentially we'll just take it down. We'll strike it, and they'll say, like, take this down. And that's because they're like, I'm the copyright owner and you need to take this down. Now, the problem is these platforms are hands off. They're like, oh, OK, I'm not going to investigate this at all. I don't want to get,
sued. They got to be neutral. Yeah,
they have to be neutral.
They don't take sides in these kind of disputes,
which is fucked up, because here's what's happening. Because anyone, and this needs to be out there, but anyone can literally go to any of these platforms and say, I own that, take it down. And the platforms will oblige if, it's not the song is not like by a major label artist or by a major publisher who have the backing and the lawyers and the infrastructure to fight this. They just take it down. So actually, I've been hearing a lot about this, and Kristen, I might have your next story for you, because
give me more work.
Yeah. So there's been two cases that I heard about that are really heartbreaking. One of them, both from indie artists. One of them is a friend of mine. He's the artist Matt B, R&B artist. He recorded this music video. He went over to Nigeria, recorded this kind of R&B Afrobeats song with a very large Nigerian artist. It was co-written by a few people, and they invested a ton of money, their own money, his own money, totally indie artist, into this video. They distributed the song, uploaded the video with this featured famous Nigerian artist, and within 2 days got 20,000 views. It's starting to go. And then somebody issues a copyright claim. It was kind of an artist that's in the scene that they have a little beef with. And he felt a little, apparently this artist felt miffed that Matt got this famous Nigerian artist recording his track and not his. And so he's like, hey, I own this, and you got to take it down. So YouTube, like, and Spotify and Apple, everybody took it down. He issued the copyright claim to everyone. And so they essentially lost, tens of thousands of dollars that they invested in this track, and the momentum. That's the other thing.
The momentum is huge. It really is.
It could take months to get back reinstated. It's now been 2 or 3 months. It still has not been reinstated, but the momentum's done. It's gone. All the press, they got a ton of press around it when it opened up. So that's a problem that has not been solved yet. But here's another one that's even more fucked up. I'm not going to use her name because she didn't want me to, speaking of sources, want me to get this out there. But basically this artist, indie artist, full-time artist, you know, makes a good living as a musician, as an indie artist. She did a photo shoot with a photographer, and they have a text and email correspondence saying, you know, I'm going to pay you for the photos. You're going to give me permission to use them on my Instagram. It's very clear. She posts the photos, no problem, whatever. They're still talking. He makes a pass at her. He wants her to reciprocate that. She doesn't, because she won't sleep with him or reciprocate the pass. He now goes to Instagram and says, hey, I own all these photos. Take them down. She doesn't have permission for me to use them. And guess what Instagram does? Instagram bans her, takes her account down. It's gone. And now she has appealed this. It's been 2 months. She can't get it back. And Instagram is also hands off. They're just like, well, you guys got to work it out. And now this is like her, essentially her abuser that is now falsely claiming this. And I've been hearing this actually more and more. And another artist came to me and was like, my ex-girlfriend just went and claimed all of these photos and videos on my Instagram. And now I'm banned from Instagram. So this is happening more. And like, as an artist right now, you know, Instagram is their lifeblood.
Yeah.
Like the way that they communicate with their fans, and they've spent years building up this audience and this fan base.
Totally.
And now Instagram or YouTube or Spotify just is like, hands off, y'all work it out. And it's a really scary place right now for an indie artist when anybody can go and do that.
That's interesting. I've never heard of people like trying to do it out of spite. I've heard so many instances of metadata errors where, you know, certain things might have gotten confused in a system and someone accidentally claimed a song or something that's like intentionally malicious, but not usually like a rival or an abuser. But that raises interesting questions. I think what it, a lot of this comes back to is independent artists and their teams are really expected to do a lot of the heavy lifting based on the system we have set up today, as far as making sure that they are getting paid for their work and figuring out their own problems with these platforms, because the platforms do have to maintain neutrality whenever there's a dispute that comes up. And it puts the onus on an independent artist. And as we both know, like there's more and more indie artists every single year. Like that's the bulk of the industry. I don't know if I have numbers for that, but you know, there's so many indie artists.
Yes.
And
DistroKids claims that they have 35% of all songs that are distributed to the DSPs, 35%. And that's just one indie distributor. So you can, extrapolate from that when there's like, 30 indie distributors or more, they're the vast majority of the 80,000 songs that are uploaded a day to the DSPs, Spotify, et cetera, are from indie artists.
I think it's just, you know, the onus being on an indie artist. A lot of the times the people who are using DistroKid and CD Baby and TuneCore, these are brand new artists that are just trying to figure it out. Yep. And a lot of them don't have the privilege of having a manager yet or a team or good people around them, which is why I like music education and stuff. Or music business education is so crucial and so hard to come by.
Yes.
You're expected to do just about everything. And I know that people talk about that a lot, but I don't think that they talk enough about the royalty collection and the copyright management part of that.
Because
you have to do your own marketing campaign and that's tough, but I think that's easier for an artist to get their head around versus like, hey, did you know that YouTube rights managers exist? I feel like a lot of them don't. I didn't know. I released a few songs in college and I had no idea that YouTube rights management was a thing until very recently. It's a lot to keep up with. And it presents, I think there's a really interesting discussions and debates happening around, the way that things are set up right now. I don't have the answers. None of us do. And people are all taking different sides on it. Some people have very different approaches to fixing the problem, but
What have you been hearing some of the approaches?
One of the things I wrote about in the story, Maria Schneider, she's a Grammy-winning jazz artist, has been at it for years. She sued YouTube and said that she felt that independent artists weren't given enough access to the tools that they need to monitor their copyrights, and that leaves them in the dark, she believes unfairly. And specifically with Content ID, she said that she really feels like independent artists deserve to have that access. And so her I think idea of a fix for this would be to open it up to everyone. Other people, I've heard a lot of people in the rights management space saying there are not that many people who have access to these tools for a reason, because they can be easily abused. And so some people are for gating it even tighter than it is now. And, you know, I don't really know where I fall in that debate, but I find it very interesting that it's happening. And it's happening in real time right now. So,
didn't YouTube countersue her?
I believe so. There was a separate person.
Her company, like Pirate something or another, they countersued or something, and then she had to drop out of it because of that, right?
Well, Pirate Monitor was the name. So she originally filed this lawsuit along with another company called Pirate Monitor, and YouTube countersued Pirate Monitor, saying. I actually don't know. I can't remember what they set off. Anyways, Pirate Monitor ended up dropping out of the suit, but Maria is still going forward with it. So it'll be, I'm really fascinated to hear where that one ends up, because I think that is a fascinating thought experiment of what would happen if everyone had the equal access to tools.
I mean, look at Wikipedia, you know, it's like, I think everybody is now, granted, there's no money flowing in, royalties flowing. There's no money on the line with Wikipedia. It's a fairly trustworthy source. However, as you have firsthand experience, as I was stalking your Instagram stories today, you got Caroline Polachek's height wrong based on a incorrect or somewhat incorrect Wikipedia or whatever you Googled that said she was 5'2", and then she had to clarify she's not 5'8" or whatever, who knows.
I couldn't figure out. To preface for anyone who doesn't follow my Instagram stories, I went to a music festival yesterday, and I was at the Caroline Polachek set, and I was standing with a bunch of people who work in the industry, and someone was like, can you believe that she's only 5'2"? She seems really tall. And I was like, she's 5'2"? And so I was so surprised by this fact that every single person I walked up to, I was like, hey, by the way, did you know she's 5'2"? And I just spread this rumor on accident that Caroline Polachek was 5'2". Turns out she is 5'7", I believe.
Okay.
Sources say.
Gotcha.
Sources close to Caroline Polachek say she is 5'7". That's all I have to say about Caroline Polachek.
It's the internet, you know? Right. That's right. Yeah. Sure. Brings up, I'm glad the debate is happening right now. I don't have the answers either, but I think it's extremely important that these issues are being brought to light, you know, and these stories like this, like the one that you wrote, the one that Elias wrote, and just more stories that are being being brought to light that highlight how broken the system is, especially for indie artists, and how challenging it is for indie artists, not just to market, which is hard enough, but the royalty collection. And, you know, I appreciate that there are more advocates and companies in the space that are catering to indie artists and indie songwriters, because we need advocates and we need companies that have our backs, that know how all this works. And because you can't expect artists to figure this out on their own or to do all their own research, as much as I would like to believe that everyone has read every word in my book and has digested it to the point where they understand complete copyright and royalty collections to a T, I understand that that's not happening. And it is, you know, very, very, very convoluted and confusing. And the laws just have not caught up with technology. Like the fact that, you know, the 1998 copyright law, there's still a lot of that still in place right now, when like copyright law. This was written in 1998 in the era of like what was on the internet in 98?
Nothing. Not much. Not YouTube, not Spotify.
None of that.
The DMCA is really, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is very interesting to learn more about. And I encourage, if anyone is not super familiar with it, to take a read. It's kind of a dull read, as all laws are, but important to know how the system is set up, because this is what we have to work with now.
Yes.
Things could easily change in the future, but as you were saying, like, laws do move pretty slow and technology moves pretty fast. So,
And that's the issue. And like, you know, the Music Modernization Act passed a few years ago, and we got the Mechanical Licensing Collective out of that, which helped streamline mechanical royalties, at least in the States, a little bit better. It brought a lot more transparency to at least the mechanical royalties, which is one of the composition royalties that songwriters and publishers can earn from streams. So that was helpful, but it really was very watered down, because when you make a law, you have to, as I have firsthand experience of getting a law written and passed in California with my work with AB5 and how we had to go about that, you have to get every party. Essentially, the politicians, the legislators don't want to do anything. They're just like, y'all figure it out, hand me a bill. And it's really messed up when you realize like that's actually how legislating works in our country. Is that like the legislators don't really write shit.
It sounds like you probably learned a lot from that process.
It was, I kid you not, it was just like, oh, music industry, go figure it out. And then, you know, it was just me and 20 other people that were on there that were in the call, like hashing it out and be like, oh, we should write this, we got to say this, and we're at button heads. And then we handed it over to them and they're like, oh, cool. They signed their name to it, but they didn't write shit. And that's how it worked. The same with the MMA, the Music Modernization Act. It's like you had to get Spotify and Apple and the NMPA and the RIAA and all the major labels, the publishers and the DSPs and everybody to agree, which is like very, very, very hard. And that's why laws take forever to get written or passed. But anyway,
they take quite a long time. And it really does concern me how many, new platforms that pop up, and, you know, all of them are things that lawmakers couldn't have anticipated couple decades ago. And so we have this, that's why our music, like all of our licensing is so bizarre in this industry. Like even the term mechanicals goes back to like mechanical piano rolls on
player pianos.
Yeah. Like that's insane that we're still using that. Right. But you know, that's just like it, you know, things mutate really fast, and we just try to apply the relevant law to it and make do with what we have. That's what I love about my job as a music business journalist is like, I just get to study and look at these things and get to shed light on things that are important, important trends and changes in the ecosystem that we all have to navigate. And then, you know, maybe hopefully it inspires someone to do something with it. Like I was saying before, nothing makes me happier than hearing that a manager figured out how to use, you know, how to navigate YouTube for their artists because of a story that I did. That's awesome. But you know, I just like to tee it up and then everyone else can run with that.
Well, that's awesome. Kristen, you're doing great work. On behalf of the entire independent music community, we appreciate it and keep it up. You're doing really excellent work. I have one final question that I ask everybody who comes on the show, and that is, what does it mean to you to make it in the new music business?
I really think that making it in the new music business is just being able to make a living and keep the creative choices that you want to take. I don't think that making it needs to be top of any chart necessarily. A lot of the music that I like listening to is not stuff where I don't think the musicians that I listen to often are millionaires or billionaires. But like to, it, what a dream to be able to make the music you want to make and have people that respond to that and, you know, just get to live a nice life. And I think that to tie it back in with what we've been talking about, the dream, like making it in the music business, I think is having good access to education and tools so that you can have that living. It doesn't have to be $1 million a year, but if you can make, you know, 65 grand a year on royalties on various platforms because you figured out how to do that, that's amazing. That's really cool. So I think that that's what making it should be.
Kristen Robinson, thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Today's episode was edited by Maxton Hunter, theme music by Brassroots District, and produced by all the great people at Ari's Take. I want to let you know real quick that Ari's Take Academy is open for enrollment right now. We only open it twice a year for a very limited amount of time. That is so we can focus on the students that we do have. But right now, it is a time period that if you want to get in, head on over to ariestakeacademy.com. From touring, how to be a successful touring artist, to registration, royalties, and release. That's a full release schedule, getting your house in order, getting you registered everywhere, making sure all the royalties come to you. We have our famed Advanced Sync Strategies course. We have Streaming Growth, where we teach you the marketing that all the pros are using right now. We have touring, the special events market. Check it out. But don't take it from me. Take it from one of our students.
Hey, my name's Dana Nielsen. I'm a very lucky Grammy nominated mixer, producer, engineer, songwriter, and I'm here to tell you about Ari's Take Academy, which has honestly changed my life. It all started with this book, which a friend recommended to me. I read it, I loved it, and recognized the real need to understand the music business more. I'm very used to making records. I've been very lucky to make records with Bob Dylan and Neil Young and Adele and Rihanna and Kanye West and Post Malone and all kinds of people. Through Ari's Take Academy, I've joined like almost all of the classes and I love them so much. I've learned so much. I've started a record label. I've signed new artists. I've promoted their releases on DSPs. I've learned about marketing, about sync licensing, and the community there is incredible. That really is one of the biggest things about the ATA programs that I really didn't think would be the thing. You know, I remember reading before I bought the first class, like, you'll get access to our private Facebook group and community. And I'm like, I don't use Facebook groups. And because of ATA, I'm using Facebook groups. And now it's in a different platform, which is even much better. And the people there are gold. I go to the office hours. I go to the Q&As. I'd love to answer other people's questions when I can. From what I've learned in ATA, it's awesome. It's like, it's the best. I can't say enough good stuff about it. You should join.
Head on over to ariestakeacademy.com. Use the coupon code NMB. That's three letters, stands for New Music Business, for 10% off.